He smiled, showing his teeth. "You never married, and don't have an heir," said Fircher. "Won't that be a problem?"
"Less than you'd think," said Tuathil.
Fircher thought his expression was far too close to that of a cat who'd just lapped up a bowl of cream.
"Why did you never marry?" she asked.
"Don't you know?" asked Tuathil.
"It's heartbreaking when the one you love only has eyes for another." The King of Tamloch stared at her long enough to make Fircher feel uncomfortable. He frowned at her, then smiled.
"At least my brother has good taste."
Fircher nodded slightly and tried to keep her face impassive. Vero had told her Tuathil knew about them. But could the king be hiding feelings for his own brother? Stranger things had happened in the royal families of both kingdoms.
"Very well," said Tuathil. "Let me save you time. I'm not calling off the war. Vero and I have been planning it for far too long to stop now. Tamloch and Darren will be united. Together, we'll push the Eagle people into the ocean and put an end to the clan lands, north and south."
"Tuathil likes to hear the sound of his own voice," thought Fircher. "Vero said little, except for pillow talk after." She stopped that line of thought, even though they were in Vero's bedchamber, with all its reminders of the time they'd spent making love on the mattress not 5 feet away. Fircher considered what Dothan had told her about, Prince Tuathil and Princess Gwynedd, and what their affair implied about King Dario. Perhaps Tuathil was still figuring out his preferences when he was younger, she considered. Or perhaps he didn't consider gender as an essential qualification for selecting a bed partner. Many didn't.
"You're going to marry Princess Gwynedd and step aside to install King Dario as the sole monarch for the combined kingdoms."
"Bravo," said Tuathil. "You're every bit as clever as Vero said you were. It would be a marriage of convenience, of course. Gwynedd has assured me Dario is tightly under her thumb."
"Right," said Fircher, keeping all traces of irony out of her voice. "And your younger sister, Ruth, will conveniently die of the wasting disease while the war is in progress, leaving the succession even more clear?" King Tuathil smiled. "Is Ruth even sick, or will it all be Gwynedd's poisons?"
"Whatever could you mean?" said Tuathil, flicking imaginary dust from the cuffs of his shirt.
"You and Gwynedd weren't married when Dario was born. She was officially married to Prince Dari."
"There's the beauty of our plan," said Tuathil. "Darren's nobles and wizards will gladly accept my compromise, after our battles, or perhaps before. The King of Darren will rule the combined kingdoms, while I pull his strings with help from Princess Gwynedd."
"And a little thing like a formal marriage has never mattered in the Tamloch succession," said Fircher.
"You've been reading our history books," said Tuathil.
"I found it pays to know my enemy."
"We don't have to be enemies, dear lady," said Tuathil. "Wouldn't you love to openly share Vero's bed when the kingdoms are united?"
Fircher leaned against the tall back of her chair and glanced over at Vero's bed. Would Tuathil's plan be all that bad? Especially if it ended the conflict between Darren and Tamloch? Dario was far more than Tuathil knew, Fircher considered, and Princess Gwynedd could be dealt with. She could be locked in the blue spiral tower along the Ruthro, for that matter. Her horned owl familiar, Tuto, could keep watch. The blue spiral tower in Melyn Carrig was also an option. King Tuathil would be more of a problem, however.
"I'm tempted, Your Majesty."
"That's the idea," said the king.
"What could I do to support your plan?"
"You could smooth our way with a conclave, and advise the old queen that uniting the kingdoms would be the wisest course."
"I could," said Fircher, "but no promises. Darren's conclave is unpredictable, and Carys follows her own counsel."
"Understood," said Tuathil. "But your thumb on the scale couldn't hurt."
"As you say, Your Majesty," said Fircher. "I may want to discuss this with Vero. Where might I find him?"
"Where he can cause the most trouble for Darren, of course.
I see, said Fircher. You've been most helpful.
A good king wants to help his subjects, and his future subjects, said King Tuathel. He stood when Fircher rose from her chair. They froze in place for a moment, their eyes locked. Neither one gave ground. Fircher was the first to turn away. She reopened the gate with a word and a gesture, and stepped through into her townhouse in Brendinas.
Too bad you're not a good king, she thought, not looking back.
Chapter 24 Dothan. Every time Dothan saw the conclave's octagonal hall from the air, he wanted to reverse course and return to the reassuring rooms of his comfortable tower. The walls of the hall were made from blocks of blue-veined grey marble, and the bright blue glazed terracotta tiles on its high-pitched roof sparkled in the afternoon sun. A long rectangular wing with a flat roof extended from one of the octagon sides. It provided a safe spot for Dothan to land. He reluctantly touched down, slung his flying disc on his back, and steeled himself for the confrontations to come. He didn't have long to wait.
"It's about time you got here," said a muscular wizard, a foot taller and 10 years younger than Dothan.
He had dark, short-clipped hair, and was blocking the entrance to the stairway leading down to the 8-sided assembly hall.
"Where have you been?"
"You'll know in a few minutes when I brief the conclave, Hiblig." The big wizard was wearing a short blue-on-blue striped robe that marked him as a member of Princess Gwynnett's faction. Its length allowed him to show off his muscular calves. He looked as ready to throw Dothan off the roof as let him pass.
"You're keeping us in the dark about Tamlock's plans, aren't you?"
Hiblig wasn't just a member of Gwynnett's faction. He led it. Dothan would have been glad to postpone the discussion, but Hiblig wasn't giving him a choice.
"Tell me, old man," said Hiblig,
reaching out to put one of his large hands on Dothan's shoulders. Dothan generated a small disc of solidified sound that pushed Hiblig's hand aside.
"You're as charming and courteous as ever, I see," said Dothan.
"I've returned to brief everyone on the conclave's role in the kingdom's defence. You'll hear what I have to say along with everyone else."
"That's not good enough," said Hiblig.
He stuck out his jaw.
"I deserve to know before the others."
"People don't always get what they deserve," said Dothan. "Now step aside. Time's of the essence. I'd have given the briefing half an hour ago if I could have managed it." A small woman slid past Hiblig from the stairwell, like an otter gliding around a rock on a river. She joined the men on the roof.
"You will have to settle for 10 minutes from now," said Inthira.
She was a comfortable-looking wizard a few years younger than Dothan. Inthira had curly brown hair and wore a solid sky-blue robe, marking her as part of the faction of crown wizards supporting Queen Caris. Dothan was glad to turn away from Hiblig and lean down to hug her.
"So good to see you," he said,
raising his voice so it echoed in the stairwell behind them.
"The princess wants to replace you," Inthira whispered, her lips brushing Dothan's ear. "She wants him a senior mage."
Dothan nodded into Inthira's shoulder. Princess Gwynnett's ambitions for Hiblig weren't exactly new news. They broke their embrace and Dothan spoke.
"Everyone's waiting in the assembly hall, I assume." "Every crown and free wizard in Brendinas," Hiblig replied, sounding smug.
More of his faction lived in the city.
"I've notified the wizards outside the capital," said Inthira. "They should gate in momentarily."
"Excellent," said Dothan.
With luck, Gwynnett's faction wouldn't have a disproportionate presence.
"Let's get on with it, old man," said Hiblig,
his voice sounding like it was only a matter of time until he was in charge. The three wizards descended the stairs with Dothan and Hiblig walking side by side, each trying to take the lead. It was noisy in the assembly hall. Wizards liked to talk, especially to other wizards. Dothan stood between Hiblig and Inthira on a rectangular raised platform along one of the octagonal sides, defining the hall's broad, open space. Above and behind the platform was a carved wooden balcony. More than 100 wizards filled the octagonal floor. They stood or sat on constructs of solidified sound, catching up with each other while waiting for Dothan to speak. Some seemed hostile, some friendly, some just curious. Many wizards wore their flying discs slung over their backs.
Quite a few younger wizards painted theirs with heraldic beasts, landscapes, abstract designs, or sky-blue camouflage. As fads went, Dothan considered, painted flying discs were at least clever. The free wizards gathered in small clumps, apart from the crown wizards. They kept their conversations to themselves. It was easy to tell them apart from the wizards employed by the kingdom, not due to any clues from their physical appearance, but more from their general attitude. They tried too hard to show they were every bit as skilled and powerful as their crown wizard counterparts. For some, it came off as confidence. Others seemed like they were trying too hard. The crown wizards were close to evenly divided between those in striped robes supporting the princess and those in solid-coloured robes supporting the queen. The free wizards controlled the balance of power on the conclave, but were such opinionated individualists that they could never be persuaded to vote as a block for one side or the other. Dothan had been cultivating free wizards in the past weeks, hoping to swing them one by one to the queen's side with limited success. Even free wizards sympathetic to the queen were reluctant to say so and eliminate a potential bargaining chip. He narrowed his eyes and scanned the remote corners of the hall. Astri and her dark blue robes were nowhere to be seen.
"Good wizards," Dothan began. "We thought there'd be more time for us to prepare to fight Tamlok on the northern borders of the kingdom, but trouble is coming straight up the Brynaven to our doorsteps as I speak. An armada of Bifaland dragonships is on the river and could reach the city's docks tomorrow if they're not stopped."
The assembled members of the conclave buzzed like a nest of angry wolf hornets.
"The king has formed an alliance with Okidens province. 2 legions and 60 Roma wizards are already gating in south of the capital to aid us."
The buzzing grew louder, bordering on panic. Okidens province was second only to Tamlok on the list of Daron's traditional enemies. The thought of purple-robed Roma wizards in Daron was especially galling, since the conclave was particularly zealous about guarding its territory from magical incursions. A meaty hand grabbed Dothan's shoulder and spun him around. Hiblig was leaning over him and shouting,
"Traitor!"
Conversations in the assembly hall ceased, as all eyes and ears focused on the confrontation on the platform.
"Let me go," said Dothan,
trying unsuccessfully to step back and break Hiblig's grip.
"We don't have time for this. We have to stop the dragon ships." "We don't have time for you leading the conclave any longer, old man," said Hiblig.
A large vein pulsed red on his neck. He shook Dothan before the older wizard could push him away with a construct of solidified sound. The wizards closest to the platform gasped when Hiblick threw Dothan to the floor.
"I challenge you for the right to be senior mage of Daren," said Hiblick. "Get up and fight, or slink away like the traitorous worm you are."
Inthira laughed at Hiblick's melodramatic statement. She helped Dothan to his feet, while others echoed her laughter, and wizards in striped robes began to chant,
"Hiblick! Hiblick! Hiblick!"
"We don't have time for this, but if you insist," said Dothan, "let's get on with it."
"Clear the centre of the hall," said Inthira,
using a megaphone of solidified sound to amplify her voice. The wizards in the audience moved to stand by the walls. Hiblig jumped to the floor and strode across the hall to the end opposite the platform. Dothan walked down the steps on one side and took a position a few feet in front of the platform, opposite Hiblig, leaving 50 feet of empty space between them. "Why did he allow Queen Karis to talk him into returning to court?" he mused. "And why did I allow myself to be nominated to head the conclave anyway?" He spared a few moments to mentally kick himself, even if he'd been the compromise candidate most acceptable to the free wizards. Dothan hoped he'd acquit himself well, but knew Hiblig must have been practicing for months for this. If the excuse of the alliance with the Roma hadn't been the reason for their fight, something else would have been. The wizards lining the halls and standing in front of the platform cast more than 100 individual shields to form a protective barrier between themselves and the combatants. They wouldn't be dropped until either Hiblig or Dothan was unconscious or surrendered. The wizards in striped robes continued to chant,
"Hiblig! Hiblig! Hiblig!"
Wizards in solid blue robes counted with,
"Dothan! Dothan! Dothan!"
Most were stamping their feet.
"Ready?"
asked Inthira.
"Aye," said Hiblig, his big voice carrying over the chanting and stamping. Dothan turned to face Inthira on the platform above him. He rolled his eyes and nodded. She would keep Furcher and Queen Caris informed if he was incapacitated or worse. He knew Hiblig would be trying to kill him, not just knock him out. He shifted to face his opponent.
"Leon!" shouted Inthira.
Hiblig gestured with one hand and spoke a trigger word, generating a suit of solidified sound armor around his body that made his considerable bulk seem even larger. Then he charged. Chapter 25. Nud and Einan. Nud was in good spirits after spending time visiting with the young dragon riders and sharing a meal. Einan wasn't quite sure he liked the taste of the small pickled fish they'd fed him, but he didn't have much experience eating things with fins. The flatbread they'd shared was quite good, though, and the tart blue jam that went with it was delicious. Einan and Nud contributed what was left of the bread and cheese and smoked sausage from the basket Braith had given them early that morning. The Bifalander youths thought as highly of Einan's parents' skills in the kitchen as he did. Chi liked everything the dragon riders fed him. He scurried from rider to rider, begging morsels from each of them. The Rakanet's belly was soon full, and he returned to his favourite spot on Rocky's back to nap. The wyvern was relaxing, soaking up sunlight and admiring glances from dragon riders. He even let Holgir rub him under his jaw with the back of his axe, which apparently did a lot to boost the lad's reputation for bravery. Sigrun was clearly the leader of the wing of dragon riders, with Ranveigr as second in command. "She's a princess, so that only makes sense," thought Einan. "Do Bifalanders even have princesses?" he wondered. "They have kings and queens, so they must have them." Ranveigr was also some sort of noble, and Sigrun's first cousin, if Einan had heard things correctly over lunch. Trying to follow 12 fast, high-pitched interweaving conversational threads, most of which were about people he didn't know, hadn't been easy. Several of the girls were flirting with Nud, and some tried doing the same with Einan, making him uncomfortable, until Nud told them about Einan's girlfriend. The boys were boasting about their skill as hunters and accepting good-natured teasing from the girls. Einan shifted to sit next to Sigrun. "What's your father like?" Einan asked. "I've never talked to a king before." "He's a giant," said Sigrun. "Over 7 feet tall and as strong as a grizzly bear with a black eye patch and scar from an axe blade running from his jaw to his ear." "I see," said Einan, hoping she was pulling his leg. "Sounds like one of my uncles." "You're no fun," said Sigrun, laughing. "My father and mother can be intimidating, but not that intimidating." "Do you resemble your mother?" asked Einan. "No, her father," teased Ranveigr, "especially when she wears her eye patch." Sigrun playfully punched her friend in the shoulder and accepted a similar punch in return. "King Bajani and Queen Signy are good rulers," said Ranveigr. "They listen, and they're fair." "Do you think 50 pounds of gold would be enough to convince them to stop their invasion?" Einan asked Sigrun. "I don't know," said Sigrun. "My father gave his word to King Tuathel." "For 50 pounds of gold he'll do it," said Ranveigr, after she'd swallowed a bite of smoked sausage. "For that much, he'd even attack Rias instead." "You don't know that," said Sigrun. Then she smiled and shrugged in a what-can-I-say gesture. Einan felt optimistic.
"So long as they don't decide to take us along with the gold," said Nud. "I'm not fond of cold weather."
Einan was about to say, "But you live in Melin Carrig." Then he thought better of it.
"We'd better get back to the fleet," said Sigrun. "This was just supposed to be a scouting expedition, after all."
"And we don't want your father to be worried," said Ranveigr.
"I'm more concerned about my mother," said Sigrun.
"And rightly so, I expect," said Ranveigr as she stood. "Mount up, everyone! Time to get airborne!"
She walked toward the small gold dragons.
"We'll fly in formation around your wyvern," said Sigrun.
"Can't we just follow you?" asked Einan.
"You don't want to give the wrong impression when we get to the fleet," said Sigrun. "If you're behind us, our wizards and warriors might think you're in pursuit and try to attack."
Einan nodded.
"That makes sense."
"Einan," said Sigrun.
"Yes?" "When you have an audience with my parents, don't say the gold is a bribe. Tell them it's a gift from Daren to Bifalland, and a sign of Daren's respect for our people's prowess in battle."
I can do that, said Einan.
Maybe I should do the talking, said Nud.
He'd stood and crossed to join Einan and Sigrun when the circle of girls around him had left. Would you? Said Einan. That would be great. You don't learn how to talk to kings and queens growing up on a farm.
And you don't learn growing up with only a cranky old man for company either, said Nud. Though I've read enough history books to know the customs of the court.
The court of Darren, maybe, said Sigrun. I've read history books too, and you'd be surprised how different things are in Bifferland. All three of them laughed. Sigrun turned to Einan.
You may be better at talking to my father than Nud, she said. Ruling is a part-time job in Bifferland. My father has a large dairy farm outside Bjarniston, and sits on the stool beside me for the morning milking when he's not in town being king.
How large is your herd? Asked Einan.
20 dozen, said Sigrun proudly.
That's more than we have in my entire village, said Einan. I've done my share of morning and afternoon milking. Do you make any interesting cheeses?
Everyone loves our sharp cheese, said Sigrun. We age it for 2 years, and the two of you could talk about cows and milk and butter and cheese for twice that long. I'm sure, said Nud. We'll both speak, and you can give us a signal if we're getting off track.
I'll rub my chin if you're doing well, and put my hand on my cheek if you're not, said Sigrun. That's the best I can do.
Nud extended a hand to Einan and helped him to his feet. Einan did the same for Sigrun in turn. He remembered seeing a funny-looking carved Sharmat piece owned by one of his neighbours back in Haywall that showed a queen with her hand on her cheek and smiled.
What?
Asked Sigrun. Einan explained.
Oh, those, she said. We have 3 sets. They are funny, aren't they? Especially the queen. She always looks so worried.
Like your mother, teased Einan.
I'm the one who's worried, said Sigrun, not her.
Sigrun started to walk to her companions, who were already mounted. Then she turned around to rejoin Nud and Einan.
I almost forgot. Space is tight, even on the flagship. I'll land first and make sure they clear room in front of the mast for your wyvern.
And don't shoot us with quarrels, said Nud.
Or blast us with fireballs, added Einan.
Our wizards are more fond of lightning bolts, said Sigrun. But yes, I'll tell them not to attack you. I'll wave when it's safe for you to land.
Thank you, said Einan. Nud nodded and smiled.
Yes, thanks, he said.
We can talk about cows later, said Sigrun.
Her long blonde braids bounced as she ran to her dragon. Einan and Nud climbed on Rocky's back, pleased that the pillowcases filled with gold rings had been returned. Soon, they were in the middle of the wing of dragons, with the sun at their backs, heading for the Bifferland fleet.
Be sure to stay strapped in this time, said Einan.
Don't worry, said Nud. I will.
Chapter 26 Merry. Merry stayed even with Nisia as she guided them through the maze of dusty corridors on the lower levels of the palace. She counted turns and paces, but wasn't completely sure what direction they were heading or how far they'd travelled. They'd moved quickly along the empty, echoing stone halls for 10 minutes without encountering another human being. Then Merry saw a hooded figure waiting in the corridor ahead of them, standing in the shadows. When Merry and Nisia got closer, they saw the figure was standing next to an archway that opened to a narrow flight of stairs ascending into darkness. Nisia didn't seem concerned, so Merry let out the breath she hadn't realized she'd been holding. The figure threw back her hood.
I'll take her from here, said Astri. We have to get to the conclave. All the wizards in the kingdom have been summoned.
The closest exit to the conclave's hall is up those stairs, said Nisia, giving Astri a small bow.
I know, said Astri, and we have to hurry.
Astri put her hand on Merry's arm and tugged her gently toward the stairs.
Thank you, said Merry, breaking away and giving Nisia a quick hug. Give my best to Griffith.
I will, said the young woman in guard's armour. I'd tell you to stay out of trouble, but...
Where's the fun in that? Completed Merry. I hope this doesn't get you in trouble.
If it does, I'll talk my way out of it, said Nisia. I have an easy excuse, since Princess Gwynnett forgot to tell us you were a wizard. How can a brand new guard be expected to cope with magic?
How indeed? Asked Merry with a smile.
I don't think she knew.
Merry took Astri's sleeve and followed the older woman up the stairs. As they climbed, Astri whispered, Lachar, and a small globe of light appeared,
floating above her head. It helped the two of them see where they were going. There was a landing at the top with a solid wooden door in front of them. The door had an ornate cast-iron box big enough to hold a pair of ladies' shoes where a lock should have been. There wasn't a latch or a doorknob, and Mary couldn't see any place to fit a key. Astrid pulled her hood back up.
"It's a wizard's lock," she said. "This is the door that wizards use to get back and forth from the palace to the Conclave's hall without being seen. You need a construct of solidified sound to open it."
Mary nodded. Her earlier exuberance was muted by the prospect of her first visit to the Conclave's octagonal center. She'd seen a woodcut of the building in one of the books in her father's library.
"Create a rod of solidified sound about an inch in diameter," said Astrid.
The older wizard pointed to the lower left side of the lock.
"Insert it here, then extend it like a three-tined cooking fork to the right until you hear three clicks."
Mary followed Astrid's instructions. It was a very simple construct, and she soon heard three clicks bounce off the walls on either side of the landing.
"Good," said Astrid. "Pull out your mage stone and wear it so it can be seen. It will serve as your pass for entering the assembly hall."
Her gold and silver electrum setting was warm from resting against her skin when Mary moved it to hang outside her shirt. The circular blue mage stone in its center pulsed with inner light. Astrid took her setting out from under her robes. It was an elegant, silver openwork filigree, holding a large oval stone. Astrid's stone pulsed as well.
"It looks like the artifact Einan found," thought Mary.
"Come," said Astrid, pushing the door open. It led to another long stone corridor, much like the ones in the palace, but less dusty. Mary half expected to find an animated broom and dustpan hard at work around a corner.
"What should I expect when we get there?" asked Mary as they walked. "Chaos and conflict," said Astrid. "Princess Gwynedd and her faction will be trying to take over leadership of the Conclave. Take extra care if you speak to any wizard wearing striped robes."
"I will," said Mary. "But I don't understand. I assumed Queen Caris had been the one truly running the kingdom for the last few years. How did Princess Gwynedd's faction grow so powerful? And who was leading the Conclave?"
"Fercha led the Conclave, with help from Intira," said Astrid. "You haven't met her yet, but you'll like her. I help her when I'm needed, though I'm just the Queen's personal wizard."
"And I'm just a masterless pig in a wallow," thought Mary, "with wings." She held back a smile.
"That means you must have dragooned Dothan to come back and lead the Conclave once Gwynedd's faction got more power," said Mary.
"We did," said Astrid.
She held back a smile of her own. Mary had real talent for political analysis, even at 15. She reminded Astrid of another young woman, many years ago.
"How did you and Caris lose your grip?" asked Mary. "How could you give Gwynedd and her faction the time and opportunity she needed to challenge you?"
Astrid didn't reply for several paces. They turned a corner and had to sidestep to avoid an animated broom and round black gate on the floor playing dustpan. Mary was pleased she'd predicted their existence.
"The answer is grief," said Astrid. "Losing her husband and grandson in the space of a week took a toll on Caris and on me. We lost our focus and shut ourselves off to be alone with our pain. Our allies didn't know when or if we'd resume our former roles. And Gwynedd and her people filled the void. Like they'd been expecting it," said Astrid. "I think Gwynedd must have slipped something into our food when I was less vigilant about inspections after the state funerals. My mind stopped being fogged when I decided to fast more than a year later. I made sure Queen Caris didn't eat anything adulterated immediately afterward, and she was soon her earlier self, if sadder and maybe wiser."
"That explains it," said Mary.
"Is King Dario kept drugged as well?"
She could see sunlight entering the corridor up ahead.
"No," said Astrid. "That's one of the bright spots of the situation. Young Dario is an ally. He has no fondness for his mother, but feigns being under her thumb to avoid Gwynedd's more extensive manipulations."
"Thank goodness for that," said Mary.
They'd reached the sunlit spot. A spiral staircase led up a level. They ascended into a massive assembly hall. A pair of wizards, one in striped robes, one in solid-coloured robes, noted their mage stones and let them pass. Merry heard shouts from the other side of a wall near the spiral stairs.
Blast, said Astri. It's already started. Let's get inside.
Chapter 27 Damon.
Blast, said Damon, when they'd left the Queen's apartments.
His mage stone had just glowed with three quick flashes of blue light.
The Conclave has been summoned. I thought I might have at least another hour.
This way, your wizardness,
said Griffith, starting down the hall toward a staircase.
Where are you going? Asked Damon.
To the wizard's door to the Conclave's headquarters, said Griffith.
The big guard looked from side to side uneasily.
It's three levels below us.
I know where it is, said Damon. I had the wizard's door built myself so my comings and goings wouldn't be advertised to every busybody in the kingdom. But I can't attend a meeting of a conclave looking like this.
Damon moved his hands from his shoulders to his waist. Griffith took in his well-worn robes and scruffy, wizened-skin jacket.
I can see that, said Griffith.
Take me back to my quarters, said Damon. I should have something more impressive to wear there.
Where are your quarters, your wizardness? Somewhere in Brendina's.
They're on the second floor, not far from King Dario's study. Get me there and I can find my suite myself. And don't call me your wizardness. My name is Damon. Eldimon, if you're being formal. If you must use a title, call me Master Mage.
Gruffid's eyes grew large.
Yes, Master Mage Eldimon.
Griffith, is it? Asked the wizard. There's no need to be formal when it's just the two of us. Master Mage Eldimon takes too long and makes me feel old. Just call me Damon.
But you are old, Damon, said Griffith with a grin.
It was what Merry would have said, he was sure.
Get moving, said Damon, smiling back, or I'll turn you into a frog.
Can wizards even do that?
Asked Griffith, as he started walking away from the staircase.
Now you're thinking,
said Damon, as he lengthened his stride to keep up with the clanking armoured youth. Perhaps the lad wasn't as much of a blockhead as he seemed. Damon kept his overly protective dusting clad away from Griffith's head with a stern look. The old wizard tossed four robes down on the white goose-down comforter covering his bed. All were cut from sumptuous fabric that Griffith was sure would drape well, even if Damon's thin form made him look like he'd been on short rations for years.
You'd think the kingdom's master mage would be able to afford a decent cook, thought Griffith.
Which one do you think looks more impressive? Asked Damon. The solid blue? The blue on blue stripes?
Griffith bit his lower lip and looked uncomfortable. Nisia had asked him similar questions about her ensembles in the past, and he never managed to come up with an acceptable answer. He glanced around the room, buying time. A tapestry to one side of the fireplace showed a young male figure in dark blue robes standing in the middle of a carved wooden balcony above a crowd of wizards. Griffith pulled his eyes away. Damon was still talking.
What about the particolour and different shades of blue, or the one that sparkles?
The old wizard was staring at him, expecting an answer, so Griffith went with the obvious.
They're all a bit old-fashioned, sir.
Of course they're old-fashioned. They're 40 years old, for goodness sake. If I hadn't protected them from moths, they'd be full of holes by now.
Yes, your wizard...
Griffith stopped. Damon looked frustrated.
Yes, Damon. On you, old-fashioned would look good.
Frustration turned to exasperation.
Yes, but which one should I wear if I want to disrupt the meeting of the Conclave and make their jaws drop?
I think having Darren's near-mythical Master Mage show up would get everyone's attention, even if you showed up naked, said Griffith. Maybe, especially if you showed up naked.
That's not my style, lad. Try again. Which robe?
You support King Dario?
Of course I do. He's the king.
But not his mother, I think, said Griffith. I remember you called her the spider.
Correct, said Damon, carefully enunciating each syllable. She's a conniving, poisonous...
Then I wouldn't wear the striped robe, said Griffith,
cutting off Damon's tirade.
Blast! That's right. It slipped my mind, said Damon. Princess Gwynnett's supporters are using striped robes now. It's a shame. I won't be able to wear this one anymore. He folded the striped robe and put it carefully away in the large chest at the foot of his bed.
If you support the old queen, the solid-coloured robe would work, said Gruffydd.
I do, but it won't, said Damon. Gruffydd's eyes followed Damon, waiting for details. If I'm going to resume my place as the leader of a conclave, I want the wizards to see me as above their petty factions, here to rescue the kingdom in its time of need.
I wouldn't put it to them that way, said Gruffydd. Nyssia says they're proud and stubborn.
Nyssia? Asked Damon.
My fiancée, said Gruffydd.
Takes one to know one. I'll win them over, but I still need to decide between particolour and sparkly.
I've seen free wizards in the taverns and shops near the palace, said Gruffydd. They tend to dress in particolour.
Good point, said Damon. And since they control the balance of power on the conclave, it might not be bad to look like one. Gruffydd nodded, attempting to seem sage and not managing to. Still, said Damon, stroking his chin, it wouldn't do for the master mage of the kingdom to put himself forward as a free wizard. I may have been gone for 40 years, but I'm still Darren's most senior crown wizard.
Mm-hmm, said Gruffydd. He didn't know what else to say.
The sparkly robe it is, said Damon, a broad smile animating his lined face. Observe.
Damon held up the sparkling dark blue robe he'd selected by its shoulders, so it caught the sunlight. Couched threads of silver and gold on the sleeves and body interlocked in intricate patterns of reflecting knotwork. Its tall, stiff, loose-fitting collar was covered with pearls and silver piping.
The collar makes the robe look old-fashioned, thought Gruffydd. But it's still impressive.
Golyaha, said the wizard,
giving the fabric a shake. Luminous spiral fractal patterns were shining with a blue light resembling the glow of Damon's mage stone. Sparkling sapphire patterns pulsed across the robe, looking like a glorious summer sky full of stars. Gruffydd swiftly inhaled, then let his breath out slowly.
That's the one to wear, your wizardness, he said. It's spectacular.
Thank you. It was a gift from Princess Seren.
You knew Princess Seren?
Asked Gruffydd, his eyes going wide.
Of course, said Damon. She hadn't disappeared yet when I came to court. That was probably before your father was born.
It was, said Gruffydd.
People, even barons, married young in the Ruthro Valley.
Seren put the powdered magestone dust on herself, said Damon. It took her a week to get it off her fingers. She looked like a woad-painted Clanlands barbarian.
If you're the old master mage, weren't you the one who was supposed to find Princess Seren? How did that go?
That's a long story, lad. A tale for another time, said Damon.
He stroked his chin again as if in deep thought, and his eyes seemed to lose focus. Gruffydd watched Damon's expression with concern. It seemed like the old wizard was miles or years away.
Ahem,
said Gruffydd, clearing his throat, loud enough for the sound to echo around Damon's bedchamber.
What? Said Damon. Oh, yes, the conclave. Turn around, young man, while I change.
Gruffydd executed a crisp about-face manoeuvre. He heard rustling sounds as Damon slid his flying disc off his back, took off the plain robe he'd been wearing, and pulled the sparkly robe over his head. A soft thump marked the old wizard mounting his flying disc. Gruffydd felt a rush of air and turned back. The tapestry next to the fireplace seemed to shimmer for a heartbeat. Damon was gone. Chapter 28 Fircher. Back in her townhouse, Fircher threw herself on her bed, then rolled over to face the ceiling and laced her fingers behind her head. She needed to think, and her current configuration of limbs was her favourite thinking position.
What was wrong with Dario being king of both Darren and Tamloch? He was young, but he had promised despite his mother.
Fircher chuckled. What was wrong was Tuathel and Gwydit treating Dario as a cat's paw, she considered. No one, even a king, could be protected completely.
Dario deserved to mature into the fine ruler Fircher thought he could be, without the pressure of a manipulative mother and secret father trying to use him. She stretched her legs under her robes and tried to pull her toes toward her head while keeping her legs straight. Fircher could feel her calf muscles relax, but the tendons in her neck still felt like tightened steel wires. Of course, the same problem of constant night and day protection applied to Tuathel and Gwynedd. Queen Caris and Astri wouldn't go along with having either of that charming pair killed, but imprisoning them both in a tower on a rocky island somewhere in the ocean east of Rias would serve. Those two deserved decades with only each other for company. Unfortunately, imprisoning them wouldn't work. Fircher took a deep breath and flexed her elbows up and down like wings. It wouldn't work because Vero would find a way to rescue them. She couldn't understand why, but Vero loved Tuathel, though not in the way that Tuathel wanted to love Vero. She chuckled again. The laugh made her neck less tense. Vero could be so insightful, she thought, but couldn't see something the size of a Bifaland mammoth under his nose. Fircher smiled, considering some of the things Vero was very, very good at. The tension behind her eyes decreased and her breathing slowed, then started to speed up when she moved her hands the way Vero moved his when they were alone together. She knew she shouldn't pause to rest, there was too much yet to do, but release might keep her centered, better able to handle the stress of the conclave meeting. Her mage stone flashed 3 times in close succession.
Last, she thought, can't I have a moment's peace? Can't I have a moment's happiness? Would it be so bad if Vero and I could share a bed every night?
She pulled her shoulders back and sat up, putting both feet on the floor.
It can't be helped, and I have to get to the conclave.
Fircher was straightening her robes, preparing to gate out to the assembly hall, when 4 solid knocks landed on the front door 3 floors down. She crossed to a window with a view of the street, opened it and leaned out. 5 royal guardsmen with striped gambesons were below. 1 rapped on her door again with the hilt of his unsheathed sword, held like a hammer.
What?
Asked Fircher, her tone suggesting she'd gladly dump the contents of a chamber pot on their heads if she had one at hand.
Come to the palace immediately, said the guard in front with the unsheathed sword. Princess Gwynedd requires your presence.
Tell the princess I have other plans.
She said that's what you'd say, said the guard.
He held up a letter with a dark blue wax seal.
She told me to give you this.
Fircher sent down a bubble of solidified sound and took the letter, lifting it up to her window. She opened it and saw 7 words written in Princess Gwynedd's overly precise handwriting.
I need your help, it read. Dario is missing.
Chapter 29 Nud and Einan. Einan saw a large river ahead. It was every bit as broad as the Moravan near Tyford, and far greater than the Ruthro. From their current altitude, he could also see hundreds of dragon ships with their billowing square sails catching the wind, tacking north.
Is that the Brenhaven?
Asked Einan.
If it's not, there are 2 Bifaland fleets attacking Darren, said Nud. At least there's no trouble figuring out which one is their flagship.
Einan looked closer. The lead dragon ship was more than twice as large as the others, except for some wider vessels near the rear of the armada.
What are those ships in the back? Einan asked. They look like fat dragon ships.
I'm not an expert, but I think they're called Gnars. At least, that's what they were labelled on the woodcut in a book about Bifaland I read in Elderman's library. They're merchant ships that are probably going to haul back plunder.
Uh-oh, said Einan. I think we may have overlooked something by only bringing 50 pounds of gold.
Nud realized it only a second later.
The value of the treasure the Bifalanders would get when they sacked Brandinus. That would be a lot more than 50 pounds of gold.
Maybe we can talk them into sacking Rias instead.
Why would they do that? Asked Nud. They're almost to the city.
I wonder if that's why the dragon riders were laughing at us, Einan considered.
Probably, said Nud. Want to change your mind about meeting Sigrun's parents?
I don't know. We've got much choice about it now, said Einan, looking up.
The girls and boys on Dragonback were crowding Rocky, forcing the big black wyvern down toward the flagship.
Can't you use some sort of wizardry to stop them?
Asked Nud. I could, said Aenon, but I don't want to hurt them. And maybe King Bajani and Queen Signy would rather have gold without needing to fight.
You haven't read any of the Bifalanda sagas, have you?
Aenon shook his head. There weren't a lot of books in the comb.
They glory in battle. I wouldn't suggest that they prefer not to fight.
Right, said Aenon. I guess we might as well talk to them. We'll muddle through somehow. Aenon called on his mage stones to make distance viewing lenses and gave the fleet a closer inspection.
Hey!
He said.
What?
The pictures of dragon ships in Robin Goodfellow's peregrinations all showed them with dragon heads fore and aft. The flagship and the lead ships around it don't have them. Just flat boards above pointed prows and sterns.
Make me some lenses. Let me see for myself, said Nud.
Aenon did, and Nud used them.
You're right. I don't understand it, said Nud.
A few minutes later, they did understand. The gold dragons had guided Rocky down to the flagship. Room had been cleared for him in front of the ship's mast. Sigrun and Ranvigir's dragons landed at the front and back of the vessel, then climbed up and rested on the flat boards with their long necks sticking out beyond the prow and stern, forming living figureheads. The rest of the gold dragons took up similar posts on the other lead ships.
Now they look like the pictures, said Aenon.
Nud moved his chin up and down in agreement. Chi jumped down from Rocky's neck, stole an apple from a basket on deck, and climbed the single mast like a squirrel. When the little raconette reached the top, Aenon could hear one long triumphant
Chee!
From above. He wondered if Chi would try to hit someone with a core when he'd finished eating. Aenon would have chastised him for his theft, but he was too far above him to hear any reprimand, and Aenon had more important things to do. Nud and Aenon saw an imposing couple in their late 30s standing near the mainmast. The woman had golden blonde braids, and the man had a long red gold beard and massive arms the size of most people's legs.
That must be King Bajani and Queen Signy, said Aenon.
She resembles the worried queen in my neighbour's Sharmat set. The royal couple wore fur vests and sparkled with gold torques, bracelets, rings, earrings and necklaces, the king every bit as much as the queen. Behind them were three women in gold robes wearing thick amber necklaces. Sigrun and Ranvegir weaved through warrior sailors milling about on the ship until they got to Rocky's side. They helped Nerd and Aenon unload the pillowcases filled with gold rings and piled them by the mast. Sigrun's parents watched without speaking until their daughter, her friend, and the two young men stood before them.
Welcome, said King Bajani.
He had a warm, welcoming smile. His huge, bushy, red-blonde beard was like Einan's cousin Ewan's. Ewan was 20 years older than Aenon and fairly famous in the family for his pig-headedness. He'd made a pact with himself that he wouldn't cut his beard until the young woman he'd met and fallen for on his wander year married him. The young woman had married someone else and now had 2 children, so Ewan's beard had become quite impressive. Queen Signy moved her hand from her cheek and smiled.
"Who are your friends?"
she asked Sigrun. The gold-robed figures remained in the background.
"This is Nud, and the skinny one is Aenon, your majesties. Our wyvern's name is Rocky."
Signy motioned to one of her soldiers, who returned half a minute later with a goat for the wyvern. Rocky curled his tail around the flagship's mast and began to consume the Caprine offering.
"Join us toward the stern," said Queen Signy.
"This way,"
said Sigrun. She tugged on Nud and Aenon's sleeve simultaneously. There were 2 folding thrones set up a few dozen feet behind the mast. Bajani and Signy sat, and benches were brought for Nud, Aenon and the girls. The gold-robed figures with amber necklaces, Bifaland wizards, Aenon assumed, stood behind the thrones. Warriors with iron helmets, round shields and long-handled axes or spears kept guard to either side. It reminded Aenon of the court of the King and Queen of Flowers at the Spring Festival back in the Coombe, but with more edged weapons. The king motioned for them to sit.
"Who are you?"
asked King Bajani, once everyone was situated.
"They're bringing you gold," said Sigrun.
"Let them speak for themselves," said Bajani, smiling at his daughter. "Anyone arriving on Wyvern back deserves that at least."
"Gold?" asked Signy.
Yes, your majesty, said Nud to the queen. The first of many gifts of gold, if you'll turn your warriors' wrath away from Darren and seek glory elsewhere.
How much gold? Asked the king.
50 pounds, said Sigrun.
Shush,
said Ranveigh, putting a hand over Sigrun's mouth. She removed it in a hurry when Sigrun bit it.
Ouch!
Serves you right, sister daughter, said Signy. She needs to learn to control her tongue on her own without your help.
The queen put her hand back on her cheek and gave both girls a look that said she was shocked, shocked by their behaviour. She laughed, and so did both girls.
That's quite a lot of gold, said Bajani.
5 times what Tuathel gave us,
said Signy, rubbing a hand on her chin in one of Damon's familiar mannerisms. Nud took that as a good sign. She was thinking about it.
It's in those bags by the mast, said Sigrun.
Fetch them here, both of you, said King Bajani. It will help you work off some of your youthful energy, and I'd like to see their gift.
Sigrun and Ranveigh stood, acknowledged Sigrun's parents, and rushed back to the mast, chattering to each other like songbirds.
Children are wonderful, said the king.
I agree, your majesty, said Nud. Your daughter is charming.
I wouldn't go quite that far, said Bajani,
a smile showing through his copious beard,
especially when she's with all the other dragon riders.
Nud nodded and smiled in return. One of the gold-robed women leaned forward and whispered in Queen Signy's ear.
Who might you be?
The queen asked Aenon.
A wizard, I assume, but with a red mage stone.
Are you from a distant land across the ocean?
No, your majesty, said Aenon. I'm from the Coombe, good farmland in the west of Darren. My village keeps dairy cattle just like you do. I found my mage stone far away.
Queen Signy stroked her chin again and said, King Bajani looked over at his wife, and then turned over his shoulder to see the gold-robed figures with amber necklaces. One nodded at him.
It sounds like my daughter has been talking more than listening, said the king.
I was not,
said Sigrun, skipping up with her blonde braids bouncing, and Ranveigh close behind. She dropped her bag in front of her father, and Ranveigh handed hers to the queen. Bajani reached down to pick up his bag, while Signy was already removing a gold ring from hers. She held it up to the light, while the girls ran back to get more.
Very high quality, said Signy.
Beautiful shine, said the king,
turning a ring back and forth to catch the sun.
The first of many such gifts? The queen asked.
Yes, your majesty, the first of many, said Nud.
How many? Asked King Bajani.
How many would it take for you to seek glory by sacking Rias instead of Brendinas? Asked Nud.
What kind of king would I be if I turned on a fellow monarch like that? Asked Bajani.
A richer one, said Aenon, smiling.
Nud glanced over at Aenon and smiled back. He'd said just the right thing. King Bajani turned to his wife. She nodded.
We will take the matter under advisement, he said. How long would it take her to gather a larger gift?
That depends on how much larger the gift would need to be, said Nud.
500 pounds, said Queen Signy.
In total, counting the 50 we've given you already?
Asked Nud.
500 pounds more,
Signy confirmed. That would balance out what we could expect to extract from Brendinas.
As you say, your majesty, said Nud.
It will take us several days to collect such an additional gift. You could anchor your fleet on the east bank just to the north while you wait. There's a royal hunting preserve for the Crown of Darren there, with plenty of deer and wild boar for the taking.
Said King Bajani,
tugging his beard instead of rubbing his chin. One of the gold-robed figures nudged his shoulder and he dropped his hand.
Before anything is decided, said the king, give us a demonstration of your red mage stone wizardry.
Of course, said Aenon.
He stood and bowed to Bajani and Signy.
What would you like to see? Something big and showy, said Sigrun,
returning along with Ranveigh, carrying more bags of gold rings. The rings made muffled clinks. Aenon looked at the king and queen. They nodded. So did the gold-robed women behind them.
It will have to be a fireball, thought Aenon. That fireball I threw at the lake back in Melyn Carrick was impressive.
He looked at the river off to port. Nud
shook his head slightly, and held up one finger, pointing towards the clouds. Right, thought Aidan. It wouldn't be smart to vaporize too much of the river. People might be hurt and ships might be damaged. I'd like to have my staff for the spell I've got in mind, said Aidan. It's back with my wyvern. Do I have your leave to get it?
Sigrun, King Vajani shouted. Bring back the young wizard's staff with the next bag of gold.
Yes, father,
came Sigrun's reply. A few seconds later, she was back with more gold and Aidan's staff. He took it and twirled it a few times, trying to look impressive, then realized he'd need a lot more practice before he could. He held his staff aloft and concentrated, calling on his red mage stone for just the right level of power, and his blue mage stone for control, plus a few extra fillips to make the explosion more colourful. He closed his eyes for a moment, then opened them, and released a concentrated ball of energy skyward from the tip of his staff. Then Aidan was bowled over by three tight light force blasts from the gold-robed Bifferland wizards. Energies erupted from their amber mage stones and would have caved in his chest if he hadn't reflectively thrown up a shield in time. As it was, the blasts pushed back his spherical shield and tumbled him over and over until he came to rest against the mast. Nud was reaching for his crossbow before he realized it was still strapped to Rocky's back. Seconds later, everyone was tossed to the deck by a tremendous explosion overhead. King Bajani and Queen Signy were knocked backward on their folding thrones into the three gold-robed wizards who stopped their attack and landed in a heap. Nud was tossed over his bench and had to close his eyes to prevent himself from being blinded by Einan's fireball. Concentric rings of blue fire surrounded the glowing red ball. They turned purple where they were touched by its crimson flames. A massive boom, like the loudest peal of thunder ever heard, assaulted their ears. Waves of heat beat down on the flagship, but luckily not enough to set the sails alight. The guards were on their knees, or had the nasals on their helms pressed to the deck. Chi slid most of the way down the big square sail, digging three sets of claws into the canvas, while a poor hand still clutched his half-eaten apple. Aidan recovered first, when Rocky nudged his protective sphere of solidified sound upright. The wyvern licked the sphere enthusiastically, and had seemed to enjoy the light, heat, and noise. After creating a new sphere for Rocky to lick, Aidan dispelled the sphere that had saved his life, and stepped over to help Nud to his feet. They both helped Sigrun and Ranveigir up. The girls were unharmed, if a little dazed. They brushed each other off, while Aidan and Nud extended hands to King Bajani and Queen Signy. Guards helped the other wizards stand.
What was that about?
Demanded Aidan, as he confronted the king and queen and the gold-robed wizards.
I thought we were your guests.
It was just a test of your shields, said one of the Bifferland wizards.
A test that would have killed me if I hadn't been fast enough to raise them, said Aidan.
His red magestone was pulsing angrily, and the trio of gold-robed wizards took a step back. King Bajani, now standing, held up his hand.
You're right, he said. You are our guests. I will see that these three are disciplined for their actions.
Aidan nodded. The pulses from his red magestone slowed and became less bright.
We accept your offer of a gift of 500 pounds of gold to direct our warriors elsewhere, said the king.
That offer is no longer on the table, said Nud. The new offer is the 50 pounds we've already given you, and my friend not burning your fleet to the waterline.
We'll take that under, began Bajani.
We accept, said Queen Signy.
The three gold-robed wizards, now gathered close behind her, were nodding vigorously. Around the flagship, other dragon ships were recovering from Einan's fireball. Warrior sailors were picking themselves up and moving barrels, crates, and ship supplies back where they belonged after being tossed about. Some ships had holes in their sails, and one had tipped enough that it had taken on water. Nearby ships were helping it offload food, armor, and weapons so it could be bailed out more easily. Rocky leaned his head around the flagship mainmast and looked at Ranveigir, Sigrun and Sigrun's parents. Sigrun approached the wyvern and rubbed the bottom of his chin with the hilt of her sword. Rocky made a rumbling noise deep in his chest, and Bajani signalled to his guards to toss the big beast another goat, which disappeared almost as fast as the first.
"Do you have any stones?" asked Aidan.
Holding his cupped hands to indicate a certain size, "he needs rocks to help his digestion." Queen Signy sent a team of guards below, and they quickly returned with baskets full of ballast stones. Rocky crunched and swallowed some of the stones and a basket. Soon,
A different sort of rumbling came from the wyvern's belly.
I like Rocky, said Sigrun.
He likes you too, said Aina. He was impressed that his familiar had allowed Sigrun's familiarity. Aina turned to Nerd and